you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The headlines: anti-U.S. sentiment running high across Iran as people rally to mark the day when students took over the American embassy in Tehran 42 years ago. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah renews its backing for the country's information minister, who had slammed Saudi Arabia for its war on Yemen. And also, the World Health Organization expresses grave concern over rising COVID-19 cases and deaths, and Europe saying the continent is once again the pandemic's epicenter. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in Iranian capital Tehran. This is the World News. Our top story for this half hour: today is a very important day in Iran's history. It's named the National Day Against Global Arrogance, and Iranians commemorate the occasion by holding ceremonies to condemn U.S. policies. Hours ago, crowds of people gathered on the streets in different cities in a show of their anger at the U.S. atrocities towards their country over the past four decades. In the capital, Tehran, the protesters gathered outside a building. It used to be the U.S. Embassy before the Islamic Revolution. 42 years ago, on this day, a group of university students took over the embassy building amid anti-U.S. anger. Traditionally, on this day, chants against the U.S. can be heard from protesters who support resistance against Washington's hegemony. Since the 1979 takeover of the compound, Iranians have been commemorating that event every year by holding rallies. Peace campaigner David Swanson says the United States has a long history of meddling in the affairs of other nations by imposing sanctions and orchestrating coups.
There was some slight mention by Barack Obama, by Bernie Sanders, of that coup in Iran. But the percent of the U.S. public that has any notion that that ever happened, or that it was an early model of dozens of coups that have been happening and are up to this moment and are still being attempted in various nations on Earth, or the role that sanctions play in recent years in these efforts to overthrow governments is virtually non-existent.
Well, the top Iranian general says the recent incident in the Sea of Oman proves that Iran is serious in safeguarding its national interests and that its armed forces are fully prepared to stand against any external threat. Take a listen.
What happened on the 25th of October, the news of which was released yesterday, provides solid proof that the Iranian nation's youth will stand against any power that seeks to threaten their interests strongly, bravely, and faithfully.
The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says about 10 days ago, its naval forces foiled a U.S. attempt to steal Iranian oil in the country's southern waters. The IRGC's chief commander now says Iran has never been seeking war, but will definitely defend itself. Major General Hossein Salami says Iran is a powerful country that serves as an anchor of security in the region. He recalled the U.S. history of making wars globally and called on regional states not to expect foreign powers to bring peace to West Asia. According to Salami, the U.S. power is declining and its allies are losing their trust in Washington.
The naval forces of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, IRGC, have managed to thwart an attempt by the United States to take over a giant oil tanker in the strategic Sea of Oman. The U.S. military confiscated the Iranian tanker loaded with crude oil in the Sea of Oman, intended to unload the shipment to another tanker and then direct it to an unknown destination. But IRGC forces reacted promptly and carried out a heli-borne operation on the stolen ship's deck, gained control of the vessel, and directed it back toward Iran's territorial waters. U.S. forces then proceeded to chase the tanker using several helicopters and warships, but but their attempt at taking over the vessel for a second time was thwarted again by Iranian naval forces. The tanker is currently in Iranian territorial waters and under the protection of IRGC's Navy.
The United States continues to use oil and weaponize oil against Iran because it has not been able to overthrow the Iranian Islamic Revolution in any other way.
Iran has repeatedly warned the U.S. about its military adventurism in the Persian Gulf. Tehran says it has increased its patrols to secure the passage of Iranian ships and to combat fuel smuggling in the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman.
The U.S. will try to provoke some sort of conflict in the Persian Gulf because of this, and we have to keep this in mind because the Persian Gulf belongs to Iran and the people of the Middle East, not the United States. The United States should not be there to begin with.
Iranian officials say U.S. military presence in the region is a source of instability and insecurity. Iran believes the countries of the region are fully capable of providing their own security.
Well, the incident that took place in the Sea of Oman could have easily escalated and turned into a military confrontation between Iran and the U.S., but as it turned out, the IRGC forces were able to maintain the defensive posture throughout the operation. After all, executing a heliborne operation and recapturing the stolen consignment from the U.S. was no easy task. Tehran believes the security of this region is best left to Iran and its neighbors.
The latest confrontation between the U.S. and Iran comes amid rising bilateral and regional tensions.
The United States continues its presence in the Persian Gulf because it is a key geopolitical trade route. Most of the energy, commerce, petroleum, commodities that are exchanged on the global market are done so in the Persian Gulf. Because if we look geographically at a map, the Persian Gulf connects trade in Europe across Egypt through the Suez Canal and leads into the Indian Ocean.
Washington has tried to disrupt the legitimate oil trade of Iran with other countries. The U.S. has threatened Iran over its fuel deliveries to Lebanon and Venezuela. It believes that the sanctions it has imposed on Iran should be adhered by Iran under its so-called maximum pressure campaign. But this is a campaign that has failed, even admitted by some U.S. officials. Tensions have risen between Iran and the U.S. after the U.S. pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal. The U.S. left the deal as part of a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The campaign included tough economic sanctions combined with credible military threat. Washington's European allies failed to live up to their commitments.
For many years, since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the United States, Washington, London, the Western imperialist powers have done everything they can to try to overthrow the popular revolution, the government.
The administration of U.S. President Biden says it wants to rejoin the deal, but at the same time, it is pressing ahead with failed maximum pressure campaign against Tehran. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has also said in a tweet that the talks to remove sanctions on Iran would fail unless U.S. President Joe Biden could guarantee that Washington would not renege on the nuclear agreements in the future.
And the U.S. maintains its presence in the Persian Gulf because it sees that Iran has been able to withstand so many imperialist attacks, and also that Iran has many friends around the world. Let's recall just a few weeks ago in the lead up to this piracy by the U.S. that Iran was able to successfully bring petroleum refineries to the nation of Venezuela.
Now, talks have been set to resume on November 29th, but the talks are aimed at removing illegal U.S. sanctions imposed on Iran. That is Iran's approach towards the talks. Only time will tell whether the U.S. will remove the sanctions or that the talks would fail.
President Ebrahim Raisi says Iran wants to see tangible results out of the upcoming talks aimed at the removal of sanctions imposed on the country. Raisi says Iran will not abandon the negotiating table, but will refuse to bow down to excessive demands that violate its national interests. The president believes the U.S. sanctions against Iran are unjust and Washington needs to remove them. Iran has confirmed that talks with the P4 plus one, the remaining parties to the nuclear accord, are set to begin on November the 29th. The negotiations are aimed at removing the sanctions that the U.S. reimposed on Iran after former President Donald Trump abandoned the deal in 2018. Political commentator Heinz Gertner says both the U.S. and the EU should offer Iran guarantees for a long-term commitment to the nuclear deal.
Of course, the Iranians want that all sanctions will be removed. I think that's a stumbling block because the U.S. will keep some of the sanctions. They will want to keep some leverage. And I understand also that for Iran, it's not only an economic issue, it's an issue of pride as well. So I do think it is possible. Of course, the other stumbling block is that the Iranians, what is very understandable, because the U.S. withdrew unilaterally from the deal, the Iranians want a guarantee for the next president in the U.S. That he will not or she will not leave the deal. That's hard to do for an American president to promise this because he doesn't have the support. But there are other possibilities. For example, in the rest of the Biden administration, the Iran can conclude long-term contracts with companies for 10 years or something, which go beyond the next administrations. And I have to say, the Europeans should give the guarantee to the Iranians if the United States would withdraw, that the Europeans would stay in the deal. So I haven't heard this from the Europeans, but that would be a good move if the Europeans could do so.
The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has denounced an ongoing Saudi-led pressure campaign against Beirut over Lebanese ministers' criticism of the war on Yemen. The movement's parliamentary bloc has accused Riyadh of fabricating crisis, saying the kingdom's punitive measures are unjustifiable and amount to waging war on Lebanon. In a recent interview, Lebanon's information minister called the Saudi-led war on Yemen futile and demanded an end to it. Saudi Arabia and its allies, including the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait, summoned their envoys to Lebanon following George Kordahi's critical remarks. Riyadh also expelled Lebanon's envoy and banned all Lebanese imports, while the UAE withdrew its diplomats from Beirut following the Saudi-led pressure campaign. The Lebanese Prime Minister asked Kordahi to prioritize national interests, stopping short of explicitly asking him to resign. We reached out to political commentator Edward Corrigan for comments on this. He tells us that Saudi Arabia is obviously embarrassed by its failure in the war it's leading on Yemen and is therefore trying to paint a picture that Riyadh is the leader of the Arab world.
The Saudis are losing the war in Yemen, and this is no doubt a very big embarrassment, so they have to lash out and attack other people to try to make it appear that they are the leader of the Arab world and they have the power, when in fact they're dividing the Arab world and in fact dividing the Islamic world. The Americans, the Israelis want the Arabs to fight amongst themselves, to divide themselves, to weaken themselves, destroy themselves. And you know, if the Saudis are buying into this game, as long as the Arabs fight Arabs, they'll always be weak, they'll always be easy to dominate.
The Lebanese judge leading an investigation into last year's deadly Beirut port blast has been forced to stop work over a new lawsuit filed against him. The lawsuit requires Tariq Bitar to pause the probe until a fresh ruling. According to judicial sources, so far 15 lawsuits have been filed against Bitar. It is the third time the investigation has been suspended. The latest lawsuit comes amid calls demanding Bitar's replacement. The government's failure to change the judge leading the investigation sparked a protest in mid-October. Demonstrators said the judge is swayed by the U.S. Resistance movement Hezbollah has also called for the removal of Bitar and voiced its objection to U.S. intervention, saying it violates Lebanon's sovereignty. China has censured a U.S. report on its nuclear stockpile, calling the report overblown and full of prejudice. Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin said the report ignores facts and intends to hype up talks of a nuclear threat. He also described the U.S. and the world's largest as rather the world's largest source of nuclear threat. Reactions followed a U.S. Defense Department report that claimed Beijing was expanding its nuclear arsenal much more quickly than anticipated. The Pentagon estimated that China could have 700 deliverable nuclear warheads by 2027 and could top 1,000 by 2030. This is while China's stockpile is far less than the U.S., which currently has some 3,750 nuclear weapons. The World Health Organization warns of another 500,000 COVID-19-related deaths in Europe and Central Asia by early next year.
According to one reliable projection, if we stay on this trajectory, we could see another 500,000 COVID-19 deaths in Europe and Central Asia by the 1st of February next year.
The WHO's regional director for Europe also expressed grave concern over the rising number of COVID cases on the continent, saying that Europe is once again the pandemic's epicenter. Kluge blamed the spike on insufficient vaccination coverage and relaxation of social distancing measures. He underlined that new cases were observed in all age groups according to official data from EU members. New cases per day have been rising for nearly six consecutive weeks in the bloc. Meanwhile, the number of deaths in the region rose by 12% in just the past week. And a fishing dispute between the UK and France is headed into choppy waters, with both sides blaming the other of violating post-Brexit fishing rights. The two sides have paused tit-for-tat measures for now, but tensions continue to simmer. Saïd Pourraza looks into what's behind the dispute and why it's escalated now.
To fish or not to fish, at the center of an escalating row between France and Britain, after France seized one British trawler and fined another for not playing by the new rules.
The UK used to be part of the EU common fisheries policy that allowed all European vessels equal access to these waters. But after Brexit, everything changed. Now both the EU and UK vessels have to have licenses to be able to fish in each other's territorial waters. And not only that, they have to prove that they have done so in the past.
To make things more complicated, the self-governing British territories of Jersey and Guernsey in the Channel Islands issue their own licenses. France accuses the UK of granting a small number of licenses it's entitled to. Britain denies that.
The French have behaved unfairly. You know, it's not within the terms of the trade deal. And if somebody behaves unfairly in a trade deal, you are entitled to take action against them and seek some compensatory measures.
But why is this happening now? In France, it might have something to do with an upcoming election.
There is an election coming up, and therefore President Macron would like to wrap himself in the flag, and particularly if it's an opportunity of actually having a go at the British. But also there's an issue that actually, in terms of a broader EU sense, that actually want to make sure that Britain isn't seen to be benefiting by leaving the Union.
And on this side of the channel, it's all about reminding British voters of the perks of Brexit.
The British Prime Minister, Johnson, is trying to make sure that he is seen to be strong, standing up against the French, and that Brexit is being a success. The fishing industry as a part of the economy is tiny in Britain, but it's a very emotional issue. And of course there, he said he would be standing up and protecting the fishing industry, and frankly, he hasn't been doing so.
The French have threatened to prevent British vessels from docking at their ports if the issue isn't resolved soon, against Britain's threats of legal action. For now, though, the two sides seem to have hit the pause button on tit-for-tat measures. Key talks are set for later this week, with experts saying the risk of further escalation remains. Saïd Pourraza, Dover, United Kingdom.
Well, the races for governor in the U.S. states of Virginia and New Jersey are over, and the results are now in. Many believe the results are sending worrying signals to President Joe Biden's Democratic Party ahead of next year's midterm elections. In New Jersey, Democrat Governor Phil Murphy has been reelected with a slim victory against his Republican challenger, Jack Cittarelli. This is the first time in 44 years that a Democrat governor is winning re-election in the state. Still, Democrats are viewing the razor-thin margin between the two candidates as a troubling sign to their party. Also, a major defeat for the party in the state of Virginia, where Republican Glenn Youngkin has won the race. He defeated former Democrat Governor Terry McAuliffe to become the state's first Republican governor in more than a decade. The results have driven many to predict bigger losses for Democrats in the House elections next year. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Fatemiya. Please stay with us.
هر ماه نوری داره، هر روز نوری داره. ما هستیم که این نورها رو حفظ بکنیم. اینا مجانی میاد در خونه ما. شیعیان امیرالمومنین علیه السلام نزد خدا.
Every month has its own illuminations, and every day has its illuminations as well. It is up to us to capture these illuminous lights. These illuminations knock on our door and seek us out free of charge. The Shias of Imam Ali, the Commander of the Faithful, are dear to Allah. If they are mindful of their prayers, good to their parents, refrain from backbiting, are well-mannered and humble, God willing, the illuminations will seek them out every day. But our wrong action is that we can't keep those illuminations. I would like to tell you, dear listeners, a good point, so that whenever you act upon this point, you remember me and you pray for me. There was a scholar who lived for about 6 months with the late Agha Sheikh Hassan Ali Nukhudaki, who was a famous spiritual teacher and mystic, an arif. Once I visited that scholar and asked him, how did Sheikh Hassan Ali Nukhudaki reach this high status of spirituality? That scholar replied, he held on to whatever blessing came to him.
اون چکیدهش میخوام که خستتون نکنم خلاصش این است گفت ایشون هرچی که به دست می آورد نگه می داشت.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review. welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlement on the Palestinians from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation, and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
You cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came and conquered and confiscated.
In these camps of misery lived the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
This is ours, in every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Close to, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
This is not fair. So remember where you come from. Wait. It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish. It's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
3 a.m. and the killing is going on. Imagine, the United States paying for all this.
First of all, very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power. And as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events. And I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing.
And what are some of those angles you think you mentioned?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given at the very least cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, and often are openly critical of official state policy. It is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to maneuver, room for negotiation.
It is very refreshing to see.
Yeah, very much so.
And Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's
very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think Elizabeth finds extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, "Oh, it's there's violence on both sides. I was shot at once. I was shot at in my car with a machine gun," and then he's asked later on, "Why do you live with your children in this dangerous area?" He said, "Oh, it only happened to once." But for Palestinians, it happens every day, not necessarily being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of our of what we're doing and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, "When I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this." And so began the Intifada.
I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years. So you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually for a long time the only way out of this conflict has been death. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent. And all that comes through in the course of the film.
Of course, in the documentary you also see lots of statistics. It's filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show then that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realized that it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realize is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestine is now in excess of 10,000. So that the actually the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal one, an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground. It is talking to people, who are caught up in this conflict, either on one side or the other. So it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about, some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have some, yes.
Yeah, exactly. What you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. To see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads. You can see the roads. I don't talk about lights. I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said,
No bees at all. There is no bees at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No. It happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy, as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Chayadu Aglit, a two-legged enemy. We are reenacting without being able to control it. We are reenacting what happened to us as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you following from that clip of that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yes, well, that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue because there's been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation which is slightly different with all its identifying characteristics and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, which is, I think, in this documentary, absolutely starkly evident that it's apartheid in Israel.
Mm. And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect of this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realize the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements, built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why then is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against a resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly pass resolutions in Parliament saying we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing. And therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society which has to adopt boycott, divestment and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. You'll see there are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. If you can imagine that, the kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most heinous crimes committed against Palestinians, and my Israeli friends would stand with me in saying the same thing.
The fact that there are Americans who are tolerating in Israel what they would not tolerate in the United States itself, and American Jews who accept that Israel behave in a way which they would very much object to people behaving in the United States itself, is very bad for Israel.
And Mike, what did you make of this part of the documentary? Was this another refreshing angle to see on this conflict?
Certainly. I mean, it's telling that actually the production company responsible is called Journeyman Films, because this is the work of an American director, a veteran American director, probably wasn't quite as veteran as when he first started shooting all this and then when he came out of it. But it is, I think, clearly the work of an American director possessed of a conscience enough to want to bring this conflict back home to America and to show the American people exactly what's going on in this particular part of the world. And it does a very good job of defining this very complex relationship between the US and Israel as we go into the final half hour of the film.
And Jonathan, this film confronts American viewers with a sort of Israeli schism over the country's oppression of Palestine, as well as the US government's responsibility. The documentary says that over $100 billion of taxpayers' money have been spent to Israel, the most than any other country in the world. And the majority of the Security Council vetoes have supported Israel's wars. Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call then to Western audiences?
But that very much depends on how widely it gets viewed. And there is a very elaborate and expensive and effective campaign run by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs in Israel to try and blanket the world with propaganda favorable to Israel. And we have, of course, our own domestic in Britain, Israel Lobby, which was shown in a recent documentary. We have the very powerful Israel Lobby in the United States. And the media is very nearly impermeable to these sorts of arguments generally. And that the campaign to persuade people that even relatively mild criticism of Israel is probably motivated by anti-Semitism started in Israel and has been pumped out around the world. And I think the reason is they don't want this message to get out. Now, whether this documentary can make it, I very much hope so. And if so, it will have a powerful effect.
Actually, a point you just made, the documentary mentions about the media and how the Israelis are always portrayed as the victims, whereas the Palestinians are the aggressors, when actually it's the reverse situation.
Yes.
How responsible does the media, what role do they play in pushing this narrative?
Well, I think they are susceptible to it. And there is a battle going on about language. how you describe things. It's as Alice said in Alice in Wonderland, it's when Alice says to Humpty Dumpty, you can't use that word, make it mean anything you like, and Humpty Dumpty says, the question is who's to be master, that's all. Mm-hmm. And if you can control the language by which something is described, you control the perceptions. And I think that attempt is going on. We have to fight for the right to describe it as it is.
And Mike, would you agree with what Jonathan said? Do you think this documentary will serve as a wake-up call also for Western audiences?
Well, hopefully. I mean, you know, it's getting a pretty small distribution. It's being independently distributed online. It doesn't have necessarily the cinematic heft that we've seen films like Waltz with Bashir and The Gatekeepers, the documentary from a couple of years back, that were all about Israeli people talking about the failings of the Israeli authorities. So it doesn't quite have that cinematic heft. But, you know, if you can find it out, like I say, it does have some really powerful moments.
And if I could just, we're coming to the end of the programme now, if I could get your final thoughts on the documentary and if you'd recommend it.
Oh, it's certainly, you know, this situation is so tricky that, you know, any new perspective that people can find on it, it is worth seeking out for that reason.
And Jonathan, can I get your final thoughts on the film also?
Very striking how little has changed except insofar it's intensified and got worse. You see the interviews and you're not sure necessarily whether it was done in 1989, 1999, 2009. This is a continuing story, and we have failed, and we have to do better.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of the show. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.